Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage. Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hi, and welcome back to a pop-up live stream. We never do these, so I'm so excited that Chris was down. We have an extreme amount of not good news to cover. So I think we will just get right into it. First and foremost, Chris, how are you? How is Moscow?
I'm doing well. Moscow's nice. The weather is starting to change slowly. It's still nice in terms of temperature, but fall's around the corner and winter's even closer. So here we go.
Moscow. So tonight, a few hours ago, quite quickly, a sovereign government did fall. This wasn't just about social media. This was about sovereignty as Nepal tries to regulate foreign tech in its country. U.S.-funded NGOs have called it censorship. The prime minister is gone. He has resigned. Parliament is in flames. Silicon Valley is rejoicing. Why don't we take a look at what's sort of going on? So the prime minister and the president have both resigned. The former prime minister's wife has been killed. Chris, before we get into what's actually happening inside the country, why don't you give our viewers an idea about how the government is structured and what Nepal is like?
So I had the great honor and privilege of having lived in Nepal for nearly half a year. I went for the first time around 2010-11, my senior year in college, and then was able to spend another few months there in between college and grad school. And one thing that was clear was after the abolition, it just was after a few years after the abolition of the monarchy. So Nepal, like neighboring countries, had a monarchy, hereditary monarchy. Eventually, in 2008, after a prolonged people's war, the communist forces, which were Maoist, the Maoist guerrillas were victorious and were able to finally dislodge the monarchy, and the monarchy was abolished. So Nepal quickly transformed into what we, you know, can classically say is a secular democratic republic. And so in that sense, there was a peaceful transition afterwards of power to main communist parties. And of course, there have been various factions of these communist parties. They've split and split, which is, you know, classic. But, you know, basically what you have is you have this large communist party and a few smaller ones that basically are in government. And now they are close to China. They've had a tenuous relationship over their history, but they're generally close to China. They have, of course, cultural and religious ties and ethnic ties in many ways to India. So there's still ongoing relations and deep relations with India, as well as also some of the other neighbors, which don't get talked about too much, but there have been issues with, it's not really a neighbor, but Bhutan, a little bit away, has actually expelled many of its Nepalese population in a ethnic cleansing that doesn't bode well for how they like to present themselves as, like, you know, sort of this peaceful, harmonious little country in the Himalayas. So there's been a lot of things going on in Nepal. Of course, Nepal is very strategic. Nepal is a Himalayan country. Mount Everest is shared between the People's Republic of China, what we call the Tibetan side, and the Nepalese side. Nepal is a diverse country, many different groups of people, many religions, of course, predominantly Hinduism, Buddhism, but also Islam as well, which forms a major part in terms of minority religious traditions. And one of the things to understand is that in the course of the development of the Belt and Road Initiative, a lot of other integration in terms of Eurasia, and especially in terms of the Himalayas, which, by the way, this region is the key to water, fresh water in the region. So with all of the transformations going on environmentally and things like that, that's been a hotspot. And there've been a lot of NGOs, a lot of our activists, a lot of people there going and speaking about it, not to mention a tourism industry that has catered to not necessarily the best quality tourists, but we know. So in any case, I think that what you've seen over the past few years has been a gradual, degradation of some of the key aspects of the communist base of support. And in the cities, sort of NGOification of society, really because of the economic issues that plague Nepalese society, many of the sort of educated strata of young people ended up working for many of these Western NGOs and organizations, and so would actually train abroad. They'd come to the US, they'd go to Europe, they'd go to some places like that. And of course, there's been the antithesis of that is a lot of young people coming to Russia and trying to study there or studying in China. So what you're seeing on the streets right now is very, very reminiscent of what we have seen in many other capitals and countries that have been subject to color revolutions, as you well know.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. So we know that 19 people have died. There are hundreds wounded. As you've all seen, the government buildings have been burned and overran. And this came in response to a recent social media blackout. So let's kind of talk about what led up to that. So in 2023, there was Social Media Directive 2080, which was issued by the Ministry of Communication and Information Technology. This directive mandated that all social media platforms would have to register with the ministry, establish a local liaison office, and appoint a grievance officer for user complaints. Platforms had a 7-day deadline. They refused to comply. The government cited data sovereignty, and then the government blocked the ones that refused to comply. Then a Supreme Court ruling came in 2024, which ruled that all online social media platforms must register. So they upheld the initial edict, and the judgment emphasized the need to monitor undesirable content that could disrupt public order or judicial process. So this tells you they were already on to something happening. In 2025, the social media bill, which was Act 2081, was introduced, and this piece of legislation empowered a social media management unit to oversee the enforcement of the previous rulings. Platforms must ensure... Now, this is where you can just hear it. Platforms must ensure user content doesn't harm sovereignty, security, or social harmony, and must uphold data privacy and grievance mechanisms. Thank you to Brian Berletich for pointing this out. You guys, if you're not following him, go follow him. He always pulls up stuff that you might not think about. He was the first account to call these out as a Stoic color revolution. But so who's the U.S. response to this? So Chris mentioned NGOs. One of the most prominent NGOs in there right now is CPJ, which is the Committee to Protect Journalists. It's a U.S.-based nonprofit founded in 1981, which is supposed to promote press freedom and defend the rights of journalists. They're funded by the U.S. State Department, the Ford Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, Open Society Foundation, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Meta, et cetera. And of course, National Endowment for Democracy. So when they speak, it's going to obviously echo the interests of the West and Silicon Valley. And so they say that they are here to defend the rights of journalists, but they never once spoke about Julian Assange, never said a word about Gonzalo Lira. But of course, they're here to criticize the policies of Russia, China, Nepal, Iran, Syria, et cetera, et cetera. So they function pretty much as a soft power instrument. So they're there to protect the interests of Silicon Valley. So this is why the protests are being painted as a Gen Z social media uprising, this organic social media uprising. So you mentioned Belt and Road. We know that Nepal joined Belt and Road in 2017, signed a new rail and energy and trade deals with China. They've expressed their interest in the BRICS currency and obviously this independent tech law. So what are your thoughts on all of this happening kind of right now?
No, it's a lot. I mean, what, you know, looking at the images, you know, today, it was very reminiscent. And I sent this to, you know, some group chats, including ours. It was very reminiscent of like 1989. Here you have a government in power that's communist and you have a bunch of young people coming out with, by the way, English signs. I mean, like a lot of the signs and slogans and things just seemed out of place for me. Of course, English is spoken in Nepal, no doubt about it. Right. But just for that, it felt like it was for a foreign audience. It wasn't for a domestic audience. And you just look at these images. I mean, this is catastrophic, really. But also note that it's not massive. It's not like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. It's gangs. It's marauding gangs of a couple thousand that are going out there. And yep. I think that when you saw these things and you saw, for example, people burned, people being beaten on the street, Molotov cocktails like we saw. I mean, this kind of stuff doesn't just happen, you know, spontaneously. This is planned and organized before. We're just coming off the heels of the SCO meeting in Tianjin and the 80th anniversary victory over fascism parade in Beijing. So when you're looking at that and when you're seeing closer and closer cooperation, especially in Asia, especially amongst these countries that are much more, I think, focused on the South than the North, or you could say the Northwest, then I think that what you're realizing is that there's the game's afoot, because we have to put this in the context of the broader region. Nepal borders China to the north and India to the south. China and India both have ongoing disputes over the border. And those border regions that are disputed are to both sides of Nepal. Sikkim, where I spent a lot of time. Sikkim was an independent country until the 70s, gave up its country's sovereignty to India to become part of India. So Sikkim was a little Buddhist kingdom. It's now there as part of India. You need special permission to visit. But basically, its border is also contested. And then you have Leh and Ladakh, which of course then borders Kashmir, Jammu and Kashmir. So you have that area, which is hotly contested. And so you understand this is a focal point. If you really want to stir the pot and you want to start to divide that picture we just saw of Putin, Xi, and Modi together, if you want to stir the pot, why not the sort of linchpin, you know, this perfect, you know, what is it, the stone that they put in the arch, right? The keystone. If you disrupt Nepal, you can begin to unravel a lot of these, you know, at least agreed upon you could say stable situations in the Himalayas. You could really foment further chaos and unraveling in the multipolar world. And that's what you're seeing now here. And Nepal, because it's small and because it has some long-term issues that it's trying to address, poverty alleviation, things like that, it's a perfect candidate for influx of money, influx of young people getting involved, and then a quick overthrow of the government. And that's what you're seeing unfold right now. The military, of course, is out and about now. But what you're seeing today is young people out and about, you know, doing things that young people normally don't do unless you got some payment and some training. Yeah. And that's a real concern here.
That was the reaction of the viewers. They were like, Gen Z is outside.
They're protesting outside.
So who are we left with now? We have this guy who is a rapper, TikTok rapper turned mayor of Kathmandu. He has endorsed the... Now, all you need to know about this guy is that he was named as one of Time's most 100 most influential people. Now, why the hell would you name it Turan?
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Some rapper in Nepal is one of the top 100 most influential people in the world by Time. Okay. Also, he has been called by various Western outlets and think tanks. This is all you need to know as Nepal's Macron. So there you have it.
Yikes. Yikes. Not a compliment for anyone with a brain.
Right. And I'm looking through kind of like what he's his sort of, you know, what's his steez. And it looks like he's very anti-Indian, which is very interesting. People in Nepal call him a Hindu nationalist. Those who don't like him call him a Hindu nationalist. He banned Indian films in the country. And to say, you know, to push back on Indian soft power. So I thought this was interesting. As you mentioned, Nepal is a buffer state between India and China. India and China have been getting closer. How much better would it have been if Nepal was also kind of peaceful and stable while all three of them kind of work together? And now we have this buffer state in the middle sown with chaos.
No, it's exactly for this reason that this is happening and unraveling at this point. By the way, the stoking of ethnic tensions is also part of the playbook here, because you have, of course, the ethno-religious tensions in Jammu and Kashmir between Hindus and Muslims. Of course, you have the ongoing geopolitical situation between Pakistan and India. Why not bring that home to roost in Nepal? By the way, this has been stoked from outside for quite some time. I did a documentary in 2014 about the Gadamai Festival, which was the largest festival for Hindus in the region, and it was the largest animal sacrifice in the world. And it was a point of contention that Jane Goodall got involved, all these environmentalists got involved, and animal rights people and PETA people, and everybody was like, you can't do this. And actually, it was 2 million, you know, more poor Indians who would come to Nepal to be able to carry out these religious traditions. And eventually the Nepalese government banned it. And so you saw some promotion of like anti-Indian sentiment, but it was fomented from outside, a lot of it. Because of course, Nepal has some very holy sites for Hindus. Right. Devghat is a very important place, like Varanasi, for cremation and the, you know, sort of last rites in terms of the life rites for older people to go there and to, you know, basically end their natural lives and move on to the next stage for what they believe. You also have Pashuputinath in Kathmandu, which is very important for the people who are focused on Shiva worship. And you have, of course, important sites for Buddhism, important sites, other sites within the country for you know, religious pilgrimage. So, of course, it's a big issue. It's a big issue, and it's been a part of the playbook to try to stoke these tensions. And actually, there have been calls to ban Indian tourists, to ban Indian religious pilgrimage to Nepal. It's always been part of this equation. And a lot of that, for according to my Nepalese comrades and friends, is not organic. It comes from outside. It's being fomented. It's the ideological and, you know, a large scale support for this kind of ideology and these kinds of, you know, ways of thinking are not domestic. They're definitely coming from outside of Nepal, because the Nepalese and the Indians are like brothers and sisters. They've been for, you know, for millennia, really. I mean, it's no doubt about it. So this is really concerning for everyone in the region.
Yeah, let's get an update on where things are at now. So that's the military deploying to enforce a curfew and get the kind of protests quelled. What can you sort of tell us about the structure of the military and how it relates to the government? Because, you know, we get into these color revolutions and what usually happens is the what the military does oftentimes determines the fate of the government.
Of course. So the military, of course, in the monarchy period was very tied to the ruling class and to the monarchy itself. After the communists came in power, there was sort of an attempt to make it sort of a people's military, bringing in a lot of the commanders who had experience during the People's War to bring them into positions of authority. Of course, it was sort of hybrid. You had to keep some of the big generals still there, but over time trying to bring new people there. Also, it's important to note that the Nepalese military has a very proud tradition going back to the British colonial period of the Gurkhas, right? So for the British Empire, the most elite forces were the Nepalese soldiers, because the Nepalese soldiers had their training in the mountains of the Himalayas, were by far the most rugged and the most elite in terms of their training. And so therefore, they could conduct some of the most harsh operations for the British. So the Gurkhas participated in the Second World War, for example, in many operations for the British. Along with the allies. So there's an elite force within the Nepalese military, the Gurkhas, and they still have this elite training. When I was there, I was able to see some of them. Some friends of mine had family members who were Gurkhas, and they have like this special, you know, this special culture around them, a special knives and sort of regalia and things like that. So it's very important to note here that they are very loyal to Nepal. They're not necessarily loyal to a party, but they're loyal to Nepal. It looks, you know, it looks so far that the military is maintaining control and that things have sort of quelled in the capital, from what I'm hearing from over there. Of course, it's nighttime, so things have slowly calmed. But the Gurkhas are definitely badass. You know, when we were in the military, you know, it was often said that the Gurkhas could run laps around special forces in the U.S. and the famous slogan, of course, you know, because, you know, the U.S. guys would always make fun and, Westerners would always make fun of the Gurkhas because they're not like the big buff kind of Rambo style. But what they would joke, and when I was hiking in the Himalayas with one of my friends who was a former Gurkha, he told me, he said, Dalbat power 24 hour. And Dalbat, the dal, of course, you know, like lentils. They would live on lentils. Like everybody else is like, where's the meat? Where are the burgers? Where are the steaks? You know, where's the lobster? Where's the shrimp? And meanwhile, these Gurkhas are just eating lentils. But of course, because of their culture and their traditions, and of course their culinary, you know, cuisine and their history with that, lentils have a lot of good protein and also good energy. So they use the dal. To climb these mountains, right? So while the guys out there were like huffing and puffing, these guys were ascending the highest peaks in the world. So that's just to say that, of course, you know, the military there is very well trained, has a wide range of experience, and these Gen Zers can't compete with them. There's no way. that they can compete with them and outdo them. So I think that the situation hopefully will calm in the coming days with these military forces out, you know, enforcing most likely what's going to be an extended curfew and maybe even a possible declaration of martial law to maintain order. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And I'm glad most people are probably not very focused on Nepal, but there's a reason why I opened the episode with that. It's incredibly important given the geopolitical climate, and we're entering into election season / color revolution season. So it's important to keep your head on a swivel and understand the signs. I do want to read you this post from Sonny Thang. He's excellent. If you don't follow him on Twitter, please do so. He says, "I do not deny Nepal's anger, but don't mistake pain for wisdom. Empire never needs to invent corruption. It only needs to whisper in the ear of the naive. The peasant believes he rises for justice. The student believes he fights for freedom. But the crowd is always easier to steer than to educate. You say today was pure. I say it was predictable. Every empire knows the commoner is easy to provoke, easy to flatter, easy to corrupt. Yes, your suffering is genuine, but suffering is not protection against manipulation. It is the crack where the empire always slides in. This is why every revolt follows the same script. The cast is always ready, angry, naive, convinced they are authors, when in truth, only extras on someone else's stage. From the royal massacre to the street protests, from constituent assembly to today's explosions, the story has never changed. The Nepali people shed the blood, Washington edits the footage, and Empire signs its name on the film." And that was incredibly well put, especially the point of the Empire. Washington edits the footage. Like you said, these protests aren't even that large, but obviously out here they look massive, and that's by sure. Design. Yeah,
for sure. I mean, seeing buildings burning, that's the Hollywood effect, right?
Right. Well, and we have other bad news. Iran has signed on to the agreement with the IAEA today, while everything is burning around us. We're only going to touch on this quickly. This was signed in Cairo, obviously hosted by Egypt. Minister IAEA Chief Grossi and the foreign minister of Iran. This agreement reportedly paves the way for resuming cooperation and restarting inspections. There's really not a lot of details on the scope of access. So many accesses and access. But anyway, so there's no real details on that. But what this looks like is that it may have delayed or possibly prevented the snapback sanctions that were going to be imposed on it by the EU. But it's like, did those really need to be prevented? What do you think the real reasoning is for Iran to get back in bed with the IAEA?
I think there's a very complex, you know, landscape now, political landscape in Iran, especially after the 12-day war of aggression of the United States and Israel on Iran. You have, of course, the reformists, you have the hardliners, you have the conservatives, you have everybody in between and around. And I think that one of the main concerns is on, especially, I would say, the reformist wing, is the possibility of another war, and trying to do everything possible to prevent another war. Of course, for you and I think that war is inevitable, that the Zionist regime will stop at nothing to dislodge the Islamic Republic, and not only that, to see the balkanization of Iran, etc. We know the script. But I think that this was a sort of diplomatic overture. I don't know how much is actually going to happen from this. It's more for the question ultimately that we have to ask is it more for the photo shoot, or does it actually mean something deeper than that? Like, are they going to open up all of these sites that were just bombed, or the new sites that they have hit everything into or brought everything to, and say, okay, come and see it and take the coordinates and give it to your American masters, right? Or your Israeli masters. Because we know what would happen during the 12-day war was that many people were claiming, and probably rightly so, that the IAEA was complicit in giving Israeli intelligence and American intelligence coordinates of some nuclear facilities that were not well cataloged through intelligence gathering methods themselves. They relied on IAEA reports and personnel to gain more information about sites, locations, you know, infrastructure, depth, everything like that. So I think that the real question for us is, what does this mean long term? And does this mean an opening up for the IAEA, you know, 100%? Or is it just we're going to open up a few sites or just one site? That remains to be seen. And I think that we're going to wait to see what the Iranian Majlis has to say, the parliament, yeah, and what the Supreme Leader will say eventually in the coming days.
Finally, the reason we are all gathered here today.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
I woke up to this. Usually I wake up and go to yoga. This is insane. So Israel, obviously, if you haven't heard already, Israel used precision-guided munitions to strike what they thought were senior Hamas political leadership gathered for negotiations. Like, what are we doing? Okay, so we have the strike hit around midday in Doha. Obviously, you guys can see.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
It was a precision strike on a high-rise building. The U.S. Embassy had issued a shelter-in-place advisory. Qatar's air defenses did not engage or even react, which fuels speculation of either the U.S.-Israeli intelligence cooperation or the Turkish tip-off. Six casualties, including the son of Gaza chief Yahya Sinwar, two administrative aides, one Qatari guard, and at least two bystanders. So Qatari civilians killed by an Israeli airstrike that was on a building in Qatar's capital. While negotiations are taking place, no Hamas peace negotiators are even killed in the strike. What? Just go. Go ahead. I don't even...
The news today was a shock. I was out and about doing some errands here in Moscow, and I got the news on my phone, and it was came as such a surprise that Israel would violate the sovereignty.
Are you being sarcastic?
No, that Israel would violate the sovereignty of Qatar to bomb Hamas as they're discussing the peace plan. They were meeting to discuss the peace plan, that there was just this new proposal that was in the works. Witkoff was involved, the Trump administration, there was this sort of last-ditch effort. And here we are, round two again. Actually, it probably is more than that at this point that we know of, but we only know round two, where basically it's a trap. We give you a peace plan, everybody gets together. Oh, let's all get together and vote. And next thing you know, bombs are falling from the sky and people are dying en masse. You know, as someone who visited that exact building that you just saw bombed, I was last year in Qatar to interview the leadership of Hamas, the political bureau. There I am with Dr. Bassem Naeem and Osama Hamdan. And what was supposed to be an hour-long interview turned into a three-hour-long interview, 1 hour on script, 2 hours off script. And really, what we discussed was the absolute just insanity of negotiating with the Zionists, that they agreed in the spring of 2024 to what was needed. And the Biden administration was involved, the negotiators, the mediators, everybody said yes. When the negotiators from the Israeli side went back to Israel and discussed it with the political leadership, That's when everything fell apart. And so, of course, Hamas over months said, we can't negotiate like this. We agree to something on paper with the Israeli negotiating team. They leave here and then somebody gets bombed. Something happens here. Israelis do a massacre over here. They bomb a humanitarian corridor here. And they try to do everything possible to derail the negotiations. And not only that, to then say, well, we've moved our red lines. We've moved what we want. We've added new terms. You know as well as I do that in the law, you can't add new terms to a contract if it's already agreed upon. Like if you and I agreed to a contract, I can't all of a sudden add new provisions that we didn't agree to. I can only do that if you agree and I agree to them. They, of course, did not agree. They said, whoa, 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 you have to withdraw fully. But the Israelis, for example, said, no, we're going to stay in the Philadelphia corridor. We're right. Not leaving. You know, that was a big thing. Or we're going to split the Gaza Strip. Or we're going to maintain a military presence and outposts. And Hamas's leadership said, no, we want a complete withdrawal and an absolute cessation of hostilities. And one thing that was very clear, and I was able to see the documents right there, I've been in touch. I messaged Dr. Bassem Naim today. I haven't gotten through. I'm sure that, of course, situation, given what's going on, I'm sure there's security precautions being taken. But basically, we're updated on a weekly basis as to what's going on with the negotiations. I'm in the same group as Jeremy Scahill and all these people from other news sites that are basically monitoring what's going on from Hamas's position about a lot of the negotiations. And one of the things that's become very apparent is that Hamas has been very much in good faith throughout this entire negotiating period, but it's the Israelis, and especially the Israeli political leadership, that does not want a solution, does not want a ceasefire, does not want an end of hostilities. They want to continue these. And of course, Hamas at least is open to say, yes, we know that they want to continue them because their goal is the absolute eradication of the Palestinian people. But of course, it won't happen on their watch. All of the officials that I met have lost sons, daughters, family members, uncles, aunts, friends, of course, you name it. And so it's very important to recognize that there is no military solution for what's happening at all. I believe that the Israelis know that too. But what they're interested in is a protracted war. I think that they really want that. I think that there's a segment of Israeli society that is interested in sort of messianic. I mean, it's funny, they call everybody else jihadists. They're the real religious warriors now. They see this as a religious campaign. They are. If you look at the patches on their arms, they'll have the Israeli flag, and underneath them, they'll have, for example, either the Third Temple, right?
Greater Israel.
They want to have Greater Israel, right? On another side. With the borders, of course, far extended all the way to Iraq, Egypt, north to Lebanon, south to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, you have to understand that this is not a people, this is not a regime that you can negotiate with, because their objective is not in good faith. Their objective is your annihilation. Hamas knows that. And they were very clear with me that's why it was so important for me to go there and others to go there and others to listen to their perspective, because they're clearly showing why October 7th even happened to begin with, because this is a long protracted war and campaign of extermination. This has nothing to do with, oh, a ceasefire and we're going to build this and we're going to help them there and we're going to open the border here. No, this is about destroying any possibility of a Palestinian state, any possibility of a future for the Palestinian people.
Well, that's what's going on at the moment is UNGA's coming up. What we have leading up to this is 2 days ago, Trump posted this. Everyone wants the hostages home. Everyone wants this war to end. The Israelis have accepted my terms. It is about time for Hamas to accept as well. I have warned Hamas about the consequences of not accepting. This is my last warning. There will not be another. And then today, we'll just play the whole thing.
Regarding the Israeli strike in Doha, how much time or how much of a heads up did the U.S. get? And does the president support the strike?
Sure. Well, I have a statement to read for all of you with respect to the Israeli strike in Doha, and here it is. This morning, the Trump administration was notified by the United States military that Israel was attacking Hamas, which, very unfortunately, was located in a section of Doha, the capital of Qatar. Unilaterally bombing inside Qatar, a sovereign nation and close ally of the United States that is working very hard and bravely taking risks with us to broker peace, does not advance Israel or America's goals. However, eliminating Hamas, who have profited off the misery of those living in Gaza, is a worthy goal. President Trump immediately directed Special Envoy Witkoff to inform the Qataris of the impending attack, which he did. The president views Qatar as a strong ally and friend of the United States and feels very badly about the location of this attack. President Trump wants all of the hostages in Gaza and the bodies of the dead released and this war to end now. President Trump also spoke to Prime Minister Netanyahu after the attack. The prime minister told President Trump that he wants to make peace and quickly. President Trump believes this unfortunate incident could serve as an opportunity for peace. The president also spoke to the Emir and Prime Minister of Qatar and thanked them for their support and friendship to our country. He assured them that such a thing will not happen again on their soil.
A non-NATO ally bombed another non-NATO ally.
Yeah. What?
I don't. And then, of course, here's Bibi's statement. I'll just read it. Israel has no greater friend than the United States. We have dealt strong blows to all components of the axis of evil. There was an operational opportunity today to eliminate the Hamas leadership, and instructions were given to the defense minister to carry it out. The Shin Bet and IDF carried out the mission in an optimal and precise manner that impressed the whole world. The days are over when terror leaders can roam with immunity anywhere in the world. We will end the war where it started, in Gaza. We have received and agreed on President Trump's principles for ending the war. I will hold all the killers accountable to ensure the security of future generations. Hamas leaders celebrated October 7th in Qatar. We attacked them in the same place. Our enemies must know one thing: Jewish blood is not worthless. The irony of the statement. You were have an international warrant for your arrest, and you go wherever the hell you want to go.
It's the hypocrisy that the emperor has no clothes at this point. I mean, it's so blatant. Not only the violation of international law, but the fact that they keep saying Hamas doesn't negotiate. They're looking at the damn proposal. What do you think they're doing there? It's not like they're fighting from there. They don't have weapons there. They're diplomats, a lot of whom are doctors and academics and people who are professionals, engineers. They're there. They're there doing diplomatic work. I mean, the flagrant violation of all the norms. I mean, forget about the Vienna Convention and things like that. Throw it out the window. Everything's thrown out the window at this point. But one thing should be clear. There's been a lot of media back and forth, and you and I were a part of listening to this today. Media back and forth over, did America know? Did Qatar know? One thing should be clear. When these Israeli jets flew and launched their weapons, U.S. radar detected them, no doubt about it, and probably the U.S. knew before. But the U.S. also is a guarantor of Qatar's safety, and also Qatar employing U.S. technology, because it buys from the U.S. It's not like it has S-400s from the Russian Federation. They knew as well. They did.
Thank you. We looked at, I don't have it, I should have had area loaded, but that's my fault. We looked at the flight patterns. The fuelers took off from Al Udeid. The F-16s were flying around the sky. And air defense didn't activate, and Qatar didn't know?
And not only that, there were American planes in the sky and American assets. There were British planes and British patrols in the sky. I mean, come on, please. We're not born yesterday. We have an understanding of what's going on in the region.
What do you think about the reactions from everyone else? Obviously, Turkey says they condemn the strike, but they tipped off Qatar and blamed Israel for the escalation. Saudi says Saudi called Qatar's emir in support, and UAE warned that the Abraham Accords could be reconsidered. I mean, these Gulf countries just gave Trump trillions of dollars in a free plane.
Listen, this is useless. All of this, we condemn this. If you condemn them, expel the ambassador, close the embassy, sever diplomatic relations, tell your citizens they can never travel there again. Like in my Iranian passport says, this passport can't be used in occupied Palestine, right? I can't go there with my Iranian passport because the government says we don't recognize that illegal regime, right? That's imposed on the people of Palestine. But they don't do that because of big money involved. And you, when you have these much wider networks, the Gulf states, Turkey, Azerbaijan, et cetera, you know, the some of the Maghreb states, Morocco, for example, when you look at all that, you have a perfect reason why these regimes maintain their Zionist position. Qatar, like you rightfully said, Qatar gave the U.S. a 400, not even the U.S., Trump himself personally gave him a $400 million plane to use as a new Air Force One. And of course, America goes and bombs them. But of course, you know, we heard today some people saying, oh, Qatar wouldn't agree to this. You know, I'm not so sure.
Do they have? They house CENTCOM and our largest base in the world.
And also for me, I'm not so sure that I am not so convinced that these Arab leaders, besides the classic, we condemn, actually, on the inside, don't harbor a love or a fondness or at least a business type attitude towards the Zionists, because there's a lot of money. There's no money with the Palestinians. Let's just be honest at this point. There's no money to be made there for the Gulf states. There's a lot of money to be made from the Zionists. Oh, they're coming. So when you look at it in that way, and when you see Jeffrey Epstein next to Bin Salman,
thank you.
Right? And somebody said, release the files, of course, you know, we got to release all the files. When you look at that, and now we're coming up to 9/11, the Saudis were involved heavily. Oh, come on. You know, when you look at this long trail and trajectory, I mean, it was one famous military commander I had in Syria who joked with me and said, if Israel bombed the Kaaba, the Saudis would say the Kaaba was idolatry according to Wahhabi and Salafi interpretation, so we don't care. Really? The same thing they said for bombing and destroying Shia shrines and destroying, you know, the graves of the Ahlul Bayt, you know, just a century before in Saudi Arabia. They don't, this stuff, there's nothing sacred to them. They are the most iconoclastic in this way. And so forget about Arab blood, Muslim blood, they don't care. Money. That's what they care about.
Does this change at all? Well, I already had a different perspective, but on yesterday's terrorist attack in Israel that was happening on the same day conveniently as Bibi's trial was supposed to take place, and now this, and he kind of cites the terror in was it Jerusalem, or I think, or maybe Tel Aviv? He cites that as one of the reasons why, you know, today's kind of pulling the trigger, the proverbial trigger. Does this change your thoughts on the events of yesterday?
Listen, I mean, we know full well that they will exploit anything coming down the pipeline. And even if they have knowledge of it, they'll let it happen. It's convenient for them. But it's very interesting that it comes off on the heels of that big attack yesterday, a perfect pretext for it, you know, the bow on the present, so to speak, you know. That's exactly what they say, oh, look what happened. And they show pictures today in the morning, people mourning and crying and doing their lamentations and things like that. And in the afternoon, bombard another country and a diplomatic mission. And what they say, like we're saying here, Jewish blood is not
worthless.
What is it? It's not worthless.
Just tell us that it's worth more. It's worth more than everyone else's. That's what they really mean.
You know, the funny thing is that George Galloway in 2006, when on Sky News, said the inverse, that for the West, Palestinian blood is worthless. Israeli blood is worth everything. for them. Jewish blood is at the top, but Palestinian blood is worthless. They don't care how many Palestinians die. And so they keep using this. By the way, it's very funny that they keep saying that we're committing blood libel. And then they, of course, use the blood language too. I like it. I like it that there's inconsistency and hypocrisy on that side, so blatant that everybody should understand that.
Before we wrap, I want to get your final thoughts. So this takes place during the peace, whatever kind of negotiations you want to call them. The Iranian attack took place during their negotiations for whatever. They're authorizing the use of long-range weapons deep into Russian territory. Ukraine's been attacking relentlessly for the last few days. They attacked Donetsk again with HIMARS. There are negotiations. What message does this send to all of the other people that are engaged in negotiations with the United States?
No, it sends the perfect message.
Yes.
It sends the message that Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung were absolutely correct. United States is the greatest purveyor of evil, and we're going to pursue our own path. We'll have nuclear weapons. We'll be allies with the people who've always respected us and helped liberate our territory from fascism and imperialism, and we'll just go our own way. And it comes, actually, this comes on the heels of that Navy SEAL story.
That's what I was going to say. Another one, right?
Right. Kim Jong-un has not rekindled that friendship and that relationship with Trump.
I don't think it will happen.
It won't happen. Actually, yeah, somebody involved in
Minsk 2, not one inch. The murders of civilians in North Korea, the Iranian 12-day war. We have attacks on Hamas. Like, this is just, there's no such thing as negotiating in good faith.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you have to understand that for the Korean perspective. I mean, Korean civilians haven't died in this way. And there's still, by the way, there's no peace agreement yet.
That's a war. Yeah.
It's a war, right? There's still a declaration of war on the table. So with that, I think that Kim Jong-un is not interested. And I think that after the participation of DPRK soldiers in the SMO, people are realizing, wow, this is what a friend looks like, right? This is what a real friend looks like. And I think that I honestly believe that Iran, I can see it in some of the press, people are saying, look, we need to focus on our defense and we need to go to China and DPRK for our defense too. We need to strengthen our defense with them and we need to get weapons from them. We need to learn about their arsenals and buy some of their new technologies because they saw how effective it was for Pakistan against India, right? Because Pakistan was employing Chinese technology and air defenses and shut down 5 Indian planes. So now Iran's like, oh, wait a second, we got to get in on this too. I'm just saying that all of this, whatever we're seeing, whether it's negotiations we saw negotiations in Russia, America and the European allies ramp up. In Israel, Palestine, the same. With Iran, the same. With Venezuela, the same. Mm-hmm. Because when we were just in Venezuela 2 months ago with Jackson and Raibar and all the guys, they said we're actively negotiating.
Yeah, they were. They were talking about Exxon, Chevron. Yeah.
They were actively negotiating with the U.S. What does the U.S. do? Send the fleet. You see? Nobody trusts them anymore. It's worthless. It's worthless. At least hopefully people are waking up now to what we've always known. But hopefully people will be more awake and it'll change the dynamics of the international system to come.
It just boggles my mind because we have this and I feel the same way. The silver lining on the horrible actions of Israel and the United States is that it gives more evidence and credence to the fact that the West never negotiates in good faith. They never mean what they say, and they do not want peace. I mean, we discussed in depth on Sunday about them changing to the Department of War. And then you still kind of have these protests that get co-opted and you're like, oh, we're so close. So I'm glad that we got to do this sort of breaking news episode and kind of wrap it all up together, because we start off with a protest that probably started off as organic and disgruntled students that quickly gets co-opted into a color revolution and people are, kind of fooled by it. And then we get to the huge tangible evidence that everything that the United States does in all actions is just covert subversion or overt murder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. 100%. When, you know, Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, used to say,
he was so funny.
I love this famous, he had this famous speech in Tehran. And he said, wherever you see violence, murder, chaos, America's behind it. And that's
well, there's a saying in the Balkans that says, if there's two slobs fighting and the Anglos had lunch with one of them or had tea with one of them earlier that day.
That's the truth. That's the truth.
It's exactly that. So don't let your don't let your protests get co-opted. Don't get into peace negotiations with the United States or Israel. There was something that Ahmadinejad said. He said something, the funniest thing he said was, we made a task force for monitoring Israel, but then we found out it was infiltrated by the Mossad.
At least they found them, you know?
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for watching. Be safe and keep up the struggle.
We will see you guys on Sunday, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,